Talk Back Matters from the Salvos.
That's the stuff you got to watch.
When the doctor approaches us with the results of a skin test to give us the C word, it's not a happy moment. But the Cancer Council reminds us on their website at least 2 in 3 Australians will develop skin cancer by the age of 70. Now, for Deborah Hutton, a face everybody recognises, it's also a face that has been threatened with skin cancer more than once. Deb's had a pretty blessed life, most people would agree. A career as a model in Australia, Germany, Italy, the US, TV presenter, her boutique range of homewares, eyewear, a radio program nationally, a beautiful home in beachside Sydney, and she was very kind to give us some time recently, so we caught up with Deborah at Bondi Junction Library and had a chat about her amazing life.
I do feel blessed. I certainly do. I think it's one of those things. I wouldn't say I was an overly ambitious person. I've never really set out to conquer the world, and that's never been on the agenda, that's for sure, and I certainly haven't done that. But it's interesting. I've sort of found that one thing's always led to another, and I certainly believe that if you're in a position where you can make the most of a situation, then I give it 100%. And so I think, you know, if you apply yourself to something, you know, more often than not, the harder you work at it, the more luck you have, as they say. So I think probably that's where I see it.
And so it was pretty easy to get into modelling?
Look, that wasn't that hard, funnily enough. It was one of those things where I just kind of... I left school and left home at 16, so that to me was... just something that I felt at that time in my life I wanted to do that. If I was a parent and my child turned around and said, "Mum, I'm leaving home and I'm leaving school and I'm just 16, then I've got, I'd have a heart attack. I'd just have a breakdown. But I was going out with my boyfriend and he said, "You know, you should give this a go." And I thought, well, what else am I going to do? So it was one of those things. I just met some people and we did some photography and she took it into Vivian's modelling agency and she said, "Bring her in here." You know, she said, "That smile, she'll do quite well."
And so after 6 years of modelling?
I just got the point where I was just sort of pretty bored with it. I really wanted to do something else. And then I was very fortunate to get into to Grace Brothers and Maya. That's what kicked off my career.
So with everything that you've done, how did you feel when you got the news about the skin cancer on your face, of all places?
I think what scared me about this is I noticed there was something not right, and then it kind of disappeared, as cancers can tend to do. They, there's a bit of redness there, and then I sort of didn't think anything of it. Then it sort of went away. And the thing that I really noticed was that my top lip started to go numb. And that's what started to freak me out. And I really should have acted on it sooner than I did, because I don't know why. I suppose it was one of those things I didn't want to face up to, and I just left it. And I kept, you know, every time I sort of take my makeup off, I would sort of touch it with my fingernails and go, "No, it's definitely numb." So I went in and saw this dermatologist, and he just confirmed it. He did a biopsy, and there was two sort of fairly aggressive BCCs. And he said, "You know, there's going to be quite a bit to come out," because it went from one side just below my nose to my sort of top lip. And so when I left his surgery, that's when I sort of got in the car and thought, because I've seen all the stories, I've read the stories, I've seen the photos of people who have melanoma and, you know, there's huge chunks of their skin that's taken out. And I sat in the car going, you know, I've fashioned a career off my face for the last 30-something years, so does this mean that this is the end of it? All those things run through your mind. So the first person you call, of course, is your mother. And she got upset and I got upset. Anyway, just, you know, one of these, you just have to deal with things one day at a time. So,
well, you wouldn't know. You obviously had a great surgeon.
I have an amazing surgeon. I'm very careful, I think, about who I choose to lay their hands on me in any way. I had a neck operation years ago where they took out a disc from my neck, and I saw 3 neurosurgeons before we did that. So I'm very careful, and because now you don't want to be in a situation where you're being butchered unnecessarily.
Yeah, Today Tonight ran a story about a neurosurgeon who had a cocaine addiction.
Oh my God.
One woman had an injury to her neck and he operated on her, and now she is an incomplete quadriplegic.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so whenever I feel like complaining about something, I think there's a lot of people who are a lot worse off, you know what I mean?
Oh look, you know, they're by the grace of God. That's what I always say. I think that there's so many instances that we hear of and we're all touched by them when something can happen so quickly, in an instant, your life can change, or those of your loved ones around you can change. And we're reminded of that constantly. And so I think it's so important to always be so grateful and never take for granted what you have. You know, I think you have to be reminded about that. It's all, not that you want to live your life in cotton wool, and nor can you, but I think it's really important just to sort of reflect and go, you know, I'm healthy and I'm, you know, I've got all my faculties, and this is something that you can't take for granted. I've been very privileged to be exposed to a great many different people in a great many situations, and so my attitude to people and the way I deal with people is exactly the same, whether they are a gaffer on a set or they are a major celebrity or I'm playing golf with Greg Norman. They are exactly the same. I have the same attitude towards it, because you don't know. You know, everyone's got a story, everyone's different, and you shouldn't judge anybody by their position, more opposed to who they are and how they behave.
Deborah Hutton, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
That's the stuff you got to watch.
Ex-model and successful entrepreneur Deborah Hutton. She's the face we all recognise, yet threatened with skin cancer a few times now. Could have destroyed her career, but she had a good surgeon. Both skin cancers caught in time as well. Makes you want to increase your checkup routine with the dermo.
Light and life.
Life's battles are often won or lost in our minds. Mind Games with psychologist Mara Steepers from the Salvos.
Welcome to another week on Mind Games. This week we're considering the idea of healing and how we overcome and survive from those negative experiences that we have in life. And the first point that I'd like to make is that often we're forced to overcome and heal both physically and psychologically, and that the processes are often quite different. When the physical healing process is often straightforward, but as they correctly say, the emotional and the psychological healing takes a lot longer for those people have experienced trauma in their lives. So when it comes to psychological healing, what we're actually talking about there, the healing process, is about incorporating and integrating the traumatic experience into our understanding of ourselves and the world. Any traumatic experience or negative experience we have changes our knowledge of ourself, our place, and the world in really, really deep ways. So the biggest thing is that we start to then need to restructure and resense the world and where we fit in it. So Judith Herman was a writer who worked in the trauma field for a number of years and has been very influential. And she said that trauma survivors go through three stages in their recovery. The first is safety, and that's the quintessential point of recovery is knowing that I'm safe in the world and re-establishing the sense of safety in my life and in my personal being. The second stage was a stage called remembrance and mourning, where I start to look at my experience, start to retell that story and start to make sense of it and myself and what they mean, given that they're together. And the third stage is the stage of reconnection, whereby if I'm able to have integrated some of my traumatic experiences into my sense of who I am and how I'm a survivor, then I can actually start to reach out and connect with the community and really, really beautifully start to help others heal from the same experiences. So the idea of a narrative is very, very important. So the first point that I would like to make for those people who may have experienced trauma, or for people who know that someone is experienced trauma, is to encourage them to talk, but to respect silence. So two things there, really, really important. If they're willing to talk about it, please do whatever you can to sit and listen, and to, you don't need to solve or find a solution for the problem, but just allowing them to talk is so important. A lot of evidence suggests that when people make a disclosure about a trauma they've experienced, that it is an incredibly brave and courageous thing for them to do. And actually, by discourage them or dismissing the fact that a trauma has occurred for them, is actually doubling the impact. The second thing you can do is believe them. When they say something's happened, more damage is caused by not believing them than by saying, okay, I hear what you're saying, and let's see what we can do to help. And then care. Care enough to support them through that process and understand a little bit about what they might be going through, because psychological healing can be a very long process and can be quite a journey. Healing just takes time, it takes courage, it takes strength, and it takes support. So with these three things, people can actually become stronger individuals because of their negative experiences. And they say that a bone that breaks and then remakes itself is actually stronger because of that. And if people can think about the strength and resilience that they have to have survived the traumatic experience, they can actually become much stronger because of that and actually assist others on their journey.
Am I asking too much when I ask you to love me? Am I asking too much when I ask you to care?
In the news recently, there was an incident at one of the hospitals in New South Wales where a nurse was stabbed in the emergency ward. Most of us have little knowledge of what it's like working in emergency in a hospital, although reality shows like Cops and others give us a bit of an idea. Ewan is a social worker in the psychiatric triage department in the emergency department of a hospital in Victoria. And he has some very revealing insights into what the job is like and the people he meets every day. It's a tough role that is not for the faint-hearted, but we certainly need more people like Yui. Yui, what qualifications do you need to be in this role?
Firstly, to be a social worker, you've got to do a minimum of 4 years study at university. Usually you do some psychology or sociology and then on to social work. Some people do it as a postgraduate. Myself, I have a degree in psychology. I did my social work degree, then did an honours year. I've just finished my master's in forensic behavioural science and am doing my PhD now, which is in public health and mental health. For those that are working in mental health, you probably need to do a bit of extra postgraduate study of some sort to be working with CAT team or psychiatric triage.
And you're now doing your PhD?
Yeah, to be in my position, they wanted me to do some extra study and qualify myself. I have a story behind it if you're curious. One of my first shifts with the psychiatric triage team based in an emergency department, some police brought down this guy, and we call it a mad, bad or sad assessment, Chris, which basically they bring someone down and they've done something and we've got to kind of figure out whether a mental illness or their capacity, you know, was involved. And the police brought down this gentleman and I actually had no idea what I was doing. I thought, oh, I've just started this job and I hadn't started my postgraduate study yet. I had the degrees behind me and they said, do some post-grad, you know, start up with this. So they brought him down and I did a basic screen and said, seems fine. So I only went. Fortunately was reviewed by a psychiatrist later that backed up the summation. But so I basically did forensic behavioural science because I really wanted to understand the difference between mental illness and criminal behaviour and a number of things that come with that sort of study. So, yeah.
Am I asking too much? Am I reaching for stars that are too far above me?
A lot of the people that I'll deal with have developed maladaptive ways of communicating. So it might be, you know, someone with a very significant personality disorder, for example, or depression, and how they might communicate might be through harming themselves, or those with antisocial behaviours might harm others or do other things. And I've got to learn, well, these people have learned to communicate their pain in a maladaptive way, might be a trauma or something like that. Apologies if I'm getting off track here, Chris. I guess why I got into social work, originally I'd studied, you know, psychology, and I moved across into social work because I feel that there's a certain section of the community that get missed out, but someone should do something about it. Sometimes you see horrible things that make you really sad and stick in your memory for a long time, whether they be abused children or people that have come in with nasty injuries or people that have sadly died over the years, whether in the emergency department or when they've been assessed, and you can't help but feeling things following that.
Can you give us an example of a typical day for you?
Mm-hmm. A couple of examples, and obviously to reassure everyone, I'll de-identify and change details so nobody, you know, thinks that it might be them or someone they know. Look, one person once came in and they'd done a fairly significant injury to themselves, but they didn't tell us what they'd done. it was quite a significant overdose that they had done straight into their veins, and they didn't tell us. And then eventually when they started to become really unwell, they actually told the doctors that they'd done this to themselves and with the intent to die. So they brought me in, and it was too late for the guy. So basically I said to him, so, you know, why did you do it and why did you come down? And I remember him looking at me and saying, I just didn't want to die alone. So I sat with him basically until he lapsed into an unconscious state, and he's no longer with us. He was a very tortured man. So I think when you talk about some of the things that we see in ED, that's probably one of the ones that have stuck with me. But look, a typical day in an emergency department, there's not really a typical day. There's typical themes that come through. It might be someone brought down by police that's really angry and agitated and not wanting to talk with you, and you have to spend a lot of time building rapport with these people because they're really guarded and they don't want to talk with you. They've been dragged down and they might have threatened to harm themselves or harm someone. You might get someone that's suffering a very disturbing mental illness and they don't really have the capacity or insight to judge or make appropriate decisions for their health or the health and well-being of others around them, such as children. You see suicidal people, psychiatrically unwell, agitated, upset, aggressive, you know, injuries, cuts, overdoses. That's a fairly typical day. Increasingly, there's lots of worker burnout, so I start my shift at 7:30 and it's not uncommon for me to finish at 10:30 that night. We call it a double shift and it's a regular occurrence, so a typical day is a busy day. But anyway.
So how do you unwind after such a stressful day?
Look, it's a couple of things. One, it's important to have an absolute belief in what you do. Someone once asked me, do I enjoy my job? And I had to sort of like say, well, no, I don't. I think you'd have to be a little bit of a trauma junkie to actually enjoy. Nobody enjoys going down and looking and potentially being assaulted by someone. But I have a really firm belief in it. A belief in what I'm doing, that it's an important role, and it's an honour to be able to see people in times of crisis and to make a difference. And I think in the emergency department and with the CAT team, sometimes we go out to home visits or the police cells and we're involved in those sorts of things where we can make a difference and we can make a difference quickly. Now, we don't always see that. In fact, we usually see the bad news stories in the emergency department. We don't get what's known as closure very often. You kind of deal with the crisis and handball on to someone else. So to answer your question, a firm belief in what I do is really integral that gets me up and gets me going each day. I think it's important to have very supportive family. I have the most wonderful wife and I'm very, very lucky, you know, in that respect. I also think having interests outside of work are important. I play Xbox, I play squash, I try and keep fit, I go for walks, I go for runs, and I have an interest outside it as well. So, yeah, that's one of the ways that I try to unwind. I think another way is, I don't know if I mentioned I'm doing my PhD at the moment, I think arming yourself with information is really useful too to make sure that you're doing the best job that you can and giving the clients that you see the absolute best service that you can. And I think that that's really satisfying too.
And I heard you're an Xbox champion. What's your favourite game to unwind to?
I'm playing a game called Blur at the moment, which is just wonderful. It is Mario Kart on steroids, Chris. It's great fun and it's a great way to unwind with a bit of techno music in the background.
Am I asking too much when I ask you to love me?
Ewan works in the psychiatric triage department in a hospital in Victoria.
Am I asking too much?
Life's battles are often won or lost in our minds. Mind Games with psychologist Mara Steepers from the Salvos.
All right, welcome to another week on Mind Games. We're looking at what happens for us when someone around us isn't travelling too well. Someone may be feeling depressed or anxious or just really, really having difficulty managing what's happening in their life and the stress that they're going through. And for everyone around that person, it can be a quite difficult experience as well. The range of emotions can be anywhere from fear, confusion, feeling powerless, to feeling really, really worried, and then sometimes even frustrated and a little bit, you know, angry. So it's really, really important to be able to manage our own feelings around this so that we can assist the other person. And the statistics actually suggest that we'll all experience something like this. Either we'll be the person having the really bad experience, or it will be someone that we know at some point in our lives. So it's something we're all going to have to deal with. So I thought we'd talk about some really, really simple information and strategies to help us to help them, because we want to live in helpful families and communities. Some of the things that you can do are to talk and in particular, allow that person the space to talk about what their experience is. It's really, really important when you do that, that we're not offering any suggestions. We're not telling them what to do, because that often actually makes the situation a lot worse for that person. And even if the advice may be really, really sound from our perspective, we don't know if it's going to be the solution for them. And they're less likely to actually use that or put that strategy in place if they're told to do it, because it's an answer that they have to find for themselves. So avoid things like you should, you must, and any sentence that starts with you. You can talk from your own experience and use I statements. By providing them the space to actually talk about what's happening, you'll actually be able to help them to understand their situation and find their own solution, because they've got the ability to do that. So talking is really important, but also so is respecting silence. And if they're not in a place where they're really ready to talk about it, you can just let them know that you're there when they're ready and actually respect their silence, because that is a very powerful message you're sending as well. It's okay to express your worry and concern about that person and their health. And that's a really, really helpful thing in a lot of cases, because sometimes people can't see from outside of their situation. And so if you're worried about them and you're able to share that in a very sincere and supportive way, then they may actually then get some more information about their situation and help to get out of it. You can offer support however you can. It's really, really important to consider that we can provide the people in our lives a number of different types of support. So this can be physical as well as emotional as well as social. And the best thing to do would be actually talk to the person about what sort of support they need. It's one of the biggest mistakes we make when we think we know what someone else needs. And then we just inadvertently complicate the situation. So talk to them about what they need and then have a talk about how you can help support that. Encourage them, particularly if you are worried about their symptoms and they seem serious to you, encourage them to seek help, and do so by avoiding judgment as much as possible. You're not here to judge anyone. We're just here to make sure that the people in our lives get the help that they need. You can do that by being aware of what people's needs are, what the impact of the symptoms may be on the person, and actually how you can help. And then also, it's really, really important to remember that you should stay as positive as possible. People are incredibly resilient. People overcome an incredible amount of issues in their lives, and they have the ability to find their own solutions. Given the space and support, people will actually thrive. So we can all find our own solutions with a little help from each other.
Talk Back Matters from the Salvos.
It's a fun, light-hearted topic this week. If you love shopping for bargains, if you love antiques, then you must love Bargain Hunt. And if you haven't seen it yet, you're really missing out. It's a UK reality TV series where contestants are let loose at a flea market or a car boot sale to find bargain antiques and then sell them at an auction and hopefully make a profit. Bargain Hunt is in its 10th year now. They've just finished filming 5 episodes in Australia. And I have the host, Tim Wannacott, on the phone in the UK. Tim, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be joining you.
I love your sense of humour on the show. It just shows how much you must love what you do, you know.
Well, it's not a penance to have to go to work in the morning. You could put it like that.
Exactly. Can you give us just a brief history of your dealing with antiques?
Well, it's a long association. And what's so nice about the antiques business is that you never stop learning something.
Mm.
And anybody who says that they know all about everything is, of course, a complete fraudster, because when I started, I left school and didn't really know what I wanted to do. And my dad was an auctioneer and my grandfather was an auctioneer. And our little auctioneering business down in Devon, we would sell anything that moved. If it was a cow or a sheep or a pig or a sack of cauliflowers or potatoes, we had an auction market in Barnstaple in North Devon, and that's exactly what we did. We sold anything that moved, including the contents of people's houses. When I left school, I had to qualify as a chartered auctioneer and surveyor, And I got very interested in the older items that were being sold. I couldn't understand why one chest of drawers made 30 guineas, because that's what we sold in those days, and another one just like it made 600 guineas. I could not understand what was the difference, Dad, between that brown thing and that brown thing. And my father, who'd been at it all his life, said, I can't possibly tell you what the difference is. They're just antiques, aren't they? And I said, well, I want to find out some more. They both got two short drawers and three long drawers. They're all brown. Why?
And so you ended up working as a generalist at Sotheby's for 25 years.
I didn't want to be the world's leading expert in Japanese ivory okinomo, which is, for me, would be very limited and very restrictive. I wanted to know everything that I could possibly know about everything, which, of course, is an impossible task, but it's incredibly interesting.
Mm.
And Sotheby's used me as a generalist for a long period of time. But you get to a point when you have done it for quite a long time. The BBC came along and they said, we'd like you to present Bargain Hunt. I said, what, me? And they said, yes, you.
How did they find out about you?
Well, of course, I'd been on the telly in a peripheral way for years. The first programme that I was ever on was the Antiques Roadshow about 25 years ago. I filmed a few objects and that all went very well. You know, small expert roles within a lot of TV programmes had come my way while I was working at Sotheby's. In terms of what I find, as you know, on Bargain Hunt, every day when I go filming on Bargain Hunt, I find something interesting to talk to you about. And those things that I find, essentially, I do find. There isn't a raft of researchers at the BBC going out and finding stuff and feeding me my lines. I know about these objects. I find them. So when I pick up that little thing and say to you, well, look, I've just found this. It'll cost you £15, but I think it's worth £500. I have actually found that object.
Right.
And probably bought it.
This beautiful building was built some 250 years ago in the glorious South Yorkshire countryside.
You also visit a historical spot each show, which is just amazing. Is there one that really has stood out for you?
Well, the trouble is, it's like, you know, if you've been married several times, which is your favourite wife?
Yeah, right, right.
I mean, once you get into that territory, you're really getting into judgmental stuff, aren't you? Often people say to me, which is your favourite antique? And I usually reply to that one by saying, the last one that I've just acquired. Can you hold on one second? I'll just get this call. Yeah, you just got cut off, darling. I'm just talking to the very nice Chris Elliott in Australia, so I'll hang up now, all right? I'll see you in a minute. Bye-bye. That's wife number three. You've got to be very careful with number three. No, she's not. I've only had the one.
Oh, right. But
the best way to G them up is to make them think that they're wife number three. Keeps them on the toes.
That's right.
If you said to me, what's one of your favourites, then Castle Howard in North Yorkshire would be one of my favourites.
Do you know something I experience when I look around buildings that were made in the 1980s and the 90s that lacked any imagination? They're just square boxes and they just didn't care. And I just think, how precious the old architecture was, you know? It's so gone now.
Yes, I know. Well, you know, in Britain, we're now listing buildings that is protecting them that were built in the 1970s and 1980s. These sheets of glass with shiny stuff on the outside. And one does have to question the sanity of the people who are going around saying this is something that must be preserved for all time. Looking back at the time that the beautiful buildings that we admire now were built in 1720 or 1750, some of them were quite revolutionary. And I'm quite sure some people who had been knocking about at that time would have looked at the new buildings in 1720 or 1750 and said, that is the most hideous thing I have ever seen in all my life. All that stone and all those chimney pieces and all that carving, it all wants knocking down.
That's a good way of looking at it, isn't it? Before I close, can you give us a couple of tips for us when we go bargain hunting, when we go looking for antiques? Is there any way or any fast tips you can give us, there probably aren't, of knowing, hey, that's not a real antique, that's actually a copy?
it's a tough one, really, because it all comes down to this thing that knowledge is power. And in the antiques business, that is a saying that is truer than in almost any other business. You have to begin to become a bit of a specialist in a subject yourself if you're going to go about it seriously. And it sounds a bit trite, but once you've decided that you really love Dalton figures or whatever little thing it is in the antiques area that most amuses you or attracts your eye, you just have to get to learn a bit about it, Chris. You need to go to auctions where such things are sold, not necessarily to buy, but to handle them, look underneath them, ask questions of, from the auctioneer or whatever expert there may be knocking about, watch the sale, see how much those things make at that auction, so that when you then go to a flea market or a car boot, you can think to yourself, that's just like the one I handled the week before last at that auction that made £800. And the price in the flea market or the car boot is only $40. What you don't want to be doing is going out and finding a bronze for $800 that's just like the real one you handled for $800, spending the $800 on what you think is the real one and then finding out afterwards that it's not real and it's only worth $40. That's the wrong way round.
Listen, I notice on the show you wear a different pair of glasses on every shoot. This is a bit of a sidebar, but we were just wondering how many pairs have you got?
What, you think it's mad me doing this?
I think it's hilarious.
Nothing like Dame Edna's, I can tell you that. I've not gone bonkers for the sparkly bit yet. It could happen.
How many pairs have you got, do you think?
I don't know, it's a trade secret. When I'm dead and gone, somebody will count them up. I'm so sorry, we got dog trouble.
It sounds like someone's arriving, right?
No, don't worry. It's a pack of small Jack Russell dogs that are very keen on attacking everybody that arrives. He's not looking very happy, but I think I better go and rescue him, Chris.
Okay. Listen, thanks for your time.
Delightful to talk to you.
Life's battles are often won or lost in our minds. Mind Games with psychologist Mara Steepers from the Salvos.
We're living in an increasingly virtual world. We're spending more and more time with new technologies and in the virtual space. And increasingly, our social connection comes through the form of social media, and we're connecting with more and more people in the e-world. And this is definitely going to have an impact on us. And so it's really, really important for us to understand this. And in particular, there's a lot of discussion in the media about the impact of cyberbullying on social connection for kids and teenagers online. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about that and reference a recent study in the British Psychological Society research reports, which looked at online ostracism and actually looked at what happens when we get rejected online and what the experience and impact of that was. So the way that they studied this was really, really novel, and they used a game called Cyberball, which is an online game where research participants play a game of catch via the computer with two other people, or they're informed that they're playing against two other people, but really both other people are actually computer generated and they're programmed to actually exclude at certain points the participant in the research, and then they study what the impact of that was. And they did this with a number of ages from primary school all the way up to adulthood, and actually did some questionnaires then on what the impact was of that ostracism or that rejection. What they were looking for was the impact on things like people's sense of self-esteem, self-efficacy, sense of belonging, sense of connection with people. The main findings were, and this is really, really interesting for those of us who have kids, is that the findings of this study were that children, teenagers, and adults actually experience that ostracism in really, really different ways. So after being rejected by the Cyberball game, then they give the participants some questionnaires. What the results found was that children who were ostracized really, really felt that in terms of their self-esteem and who they are in relation to others. So it had a big impact on how they see themselves. Teens in particular, based on where they're at in their developmental level, really felt that it had an impact on their sense of belonging. So it was more in relation to others that the impact was felt. Adults, the picture was a little bit more general, and it affected some in terms of self-esteem, some in terms of a sense of belonging and connection, but it wasn't as clear-cut. Definitely for young children up to 12, then ostracism had a big impact on self-esteem. So it's worth considering that when we enter the virtual world with our kids and we allow them to get in touch with communities online, that this is where some of the impact may be if this happens. What's really, really important to remember and note is that after these participants were ostracized, they got to play cyberball again, in which case they were included. And that actually had a big impact then on how they felt across the board as well. So even if the impact may be felt when we're ostracized, it's nothing that we can't overcome given the conditions to do so. So if we're able to create welcoming spaces for the people that we have in our lives and not ostracize them in the real world, that will help with their ability to manage anything that happens in the virtual world.
This is Light and Life. To contact us, go to salvos.org.au/radio.